Judah's first reformer, we now call upon our brother Jim Cowie to lead us in this third consideration. Brother Jim.
Thanks, Brother James. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, this morning we learn a very important principle about divine methods. And it was this, that when Yahweh sees a problem emerging amongst his children, he always tries to nip it in the bud. And we're going to see that that principle applies to nearly every study that will come before us in the course of this week. Whether we look at the life of Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joash, or Uzziah, the same principle emerges. Yahweh attempted to nip the problems in the bud. And so in the case of Jeroboam, he sent the man of God from Judah at the most propitious time to try and turn back the apostasy of that man. It nearly succeeded, and would have succeeded, perhaps, had it not been for the failure of the man of God from Judah. We're moving on now, 20 years or so in the history of God's ecclesia, to the times of one of the most wonderful men to grace the pages of God's word. His name was King Asa, and yet, at the end of his life, brothers and sisters, he was himself a total failure. And I'm going to try and show you just how wonderful this man was today, to demonstrate that he was a man totally dedicated to the building up of God's ecclesia, to the establishing of that ecclesia on firm foundations, and that he, in fact, brought the ecclesia of Judah to heights that they were never able to reach again. Now, in making that statement, I am aware, of course, that Hezekiah later on brought Judah to enormous heights in the things of the truth. But it's my personal conviction, and I'm prepared to discuss this with anybody who doesn't agree, it is my personal conviction, having looked at the lives of both of those kings very carefully, that never again did Reformation achieve as much in Judah as it did in the days of King Asa. And I'll show you why I say that in a moment. But first of all, let's examine the quality of the ecclesia which he inherited from his father Abijah. It was in a Laodicean state because of Rehoboam and Abijah. Rehoboam, after 3 years of relatively faithful reign in the sight of God, although of course he was never a man who understood the issues of the truth as he ought. But things went well for about 3 years under his reign, and then he turned away to the idolatry that Solomon had embraced. And his son Abijah did the same. And yet Abijah looked upon himself as though he was the paragon of Christadelphian virtue, and belligerently went out against Jeroboam. And standing upon Mount Zemaraim, as is described for us in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 13, he berated Israel and Jeroboam and said, in the words of verse 10 of 2 Chronicles 13, "But as for us, Yahweh is our God." That was a lie. "And we have not forsaken him." That was rubbish. "And the priests which minister unto Yahweh are the sons of Aaron." That might have been true, but they weren't doing a very good job. "And the Levites wait upon their business." And so they did. And they kept the forms of religion. They kept up the rituals of the Mosaic law. But their religion was a sham. There was no depth in it because they were at heart idolaters. And so this hypocritical man, Abijah, stands up to berate Israel. And he goes on to say in verse 11 of this 13th chapter, "And they, the priests, burn unto Yahweh every morning and every evening. We keep the things of the law meticulously, the burnt sacrifices and sweet incense. The showbread also set they in order upon the pure table." Notice that, the pure table. He's implying, of course, that Jeroboam's table wasn't pure. "And the candlestick of gold with the lamps thereof to burn every evening. For we keep the charge of Yahweh our God, but ye Israel have forsaken him." And here is this hypocritical king standing up and giving Jeroboam a bucket. But in the meantime, of course, Jeroboam was taking action to unseat Abijah. And we read in verse 13 that Jeroboam caused an ambushment to come out behind Abijah and his men, so they were
there was before Judah and behind them a massive army. And when they looked back in verse 14, behold, the battle was before and behind. And they cried unto Yahweh, and the priests sounded with the trumpets, and they cried out to Yahweh in their distress, and he saved them. By the skin of their teeth they were saved, and he was teaching them a lesson. Abijah, you are in a Laodicean state in your ecclesia, and you're responsible for it. And you got up here talking to Israel as though you are the paragon of virtue. And so Abijah went home with his tail between his legs. And Jeroboam himself suffered greatly that day. And so we have an ecclesia that is not going very well. They have the forms of religion. They do everything right. But there's no spiritual vitality. And they needed desperately a physician. They needed someone who would apply the right medication, who would take out the scalpel and remove the diseased parts of the body. And they got that man in the form of King Asa. We're going to have a look at him and see what he did. It's a wonderful story with a sad ending. There was rapid growth in the ecclesia at that time, brothers and sisters, because from the north they poured down those who were dissatisfied with the direction of Jeroboam's kingdom. Go back a page or so in your Bibles to the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 11. Massive immigration was occurring. In 2 Chronicles 11 and verse 13 we read, and the priests and the Levites that were in all Israel resorted to him, that is to Rehoboam in this case, out of all their coasts. For the Levites left their suburbs and their possession and came to Judah and Jerusalem. For Jeroboam and his sons had cast them off from executing the priest's office under Yahweh. And he ordained him priests for the high places, as we saw this morning, and for the devils, and for the calves which he had made. And after them, out of all the tribes of Israel, such as set their hearts to seek Yahweh God of Israel came to Jerusalem to sacrifice unto Yahweh God of their fathers. And so there was continuing immigration from the north to the south. And people were leaving behind their inheritance. And to an Israelite, that was really something. We can shift from one state to another, doesn't really matter. But to an Israelite whose inheritance was in that land that belonged to Yahweh and which had been given to his fathers, to leave that, brothers and sisters, was an enormous upheaval. And to go down over south and make a completely new start in totally new circumstances meant that they had to completely change their whole way of life. They had to go about the business of starting again. And that wasn't easy. But they did it because, you see, there were good things in Judah, even though at this stage they were heading towards a Laodicean state. When Asa came along, he saw his responsibility. He saw that migration. He saw the need for a physician. And he went about the task of cutting away the diseased portions of the body. And so we have in the record of 2 Chronicles 14, 15 and 16 the life of King Asa. Now I'm going to try and get through those three chapters this afternoon, so I must ask you to bear with me if I appear to be leapfrogging over some matters. We will try to do what we can to give you a complete picture, but it is essential that we get through it to see the balance of this man's life. We see him come to the throne in verse 1 of chapter 14. So Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa his son reigned in his stead. His name means, as you might have guessed, physician. He was the physician provided by Yahweh that he might bring the medication necessary to end the problems of Judah. They were poor and miserable, blind and naked, but they couldn't see it. They were Laodicean. They needed eye salve, and along came a physician who provided that for them. But we read at the end of verse 1 something very significant about the reign of King Asa. He reigned in his father's stead. In his days the land was quiet 10 years. And that was a contrast with King Abijah, who reigned for 3 short years. And that reign was full of bitterness and hatred and belligerence towards Israel in the north. It was a reign full of those things that ought to have been absent, because he should have been applying himself to building up his own ecclesia. In the days of King Asa, it was different. And there was peace, quietness, for 10 years. Who gave it to him? Well, the record points that out in a moment. But he got it for a reason. And I'll show you the reason. For in verse 2 it says, Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of Yahweh. Now I want you just to bear that one in mind. Where it says the eyes of Yahweh, it is telling us that Yahweh was observing King Asa, as indeed he's observing all of us, that he cared for what this king was doing. And later on we're going to see that phrase, the eyes of Yahweh, occur again in a very interesting context, as Yahweh tries to turn this man back from a wrong decision. So we read in the third verse, for he took away the altars of the strange gods, or the foreign altars, as Rotherham puts it, which Rehoboam and Abijah had put in place, and the high places, although he didn't completely destroy those high places, he took away them as active places of worship. They remained, of course, to the days of Josiah. And he broke down the images, the word means a standing image, an idol, and he cut down the groves. And the word groves there is Asherim, and it has reference to the fertility god of the Canaanites. And that particular fertility god was worshipped with immorality. Now, for the sake of our young people, I think I should mention at this stage, brothers and sisters, that the first thing that King Asa did was to remove opportunity for his people to be involved in the worship of the world. He got rid of the strange altars, the high places, the standing images, and the Asherims. And you know what they are? In modern terms, what that is talking about are drive-in theatres, picture theatres, and video shops. That's what it's talking about. A high place was a place on the top of a hill where they had a high standing image, just like you have in a drive-in theatre, a big high standing screen upon which they place the images of immorality and corruption and violence. And in that high place, around the high standing image, there are smaller ones, just like the things that they've got there, which apparently are used for the sound. And you drive your car up alongside of it and use the sound. I've never been there, but that's apparently what they're for. Same thing, all over again. It was happening in the days of King Asa, and I would submit, brethren and sisters, that it's probably happened and may be happening to some who call themselves Christadelphians. We don't inhabit the high places of this land, do we? We shouldn't. Because the result will be the same sort of disaster that overtook Rehoboam and Abijah's ecclesia. And so Asa takes out the scalpel, and he understood the principle that if your high places offend you, you cut them off. But it wasn't only a cutting off of that which was inanimate that encountered Asa. He had to deal with his own flesh and blood. When you go across the page to chapter 15, in verses 16 and 17, we have a record of what he did earlier in his reign, which for some reason is placed here at the end of chapter 15. We read in the 16th verse, and also concerning Maacah, the mother, or as it should be, the grandmother, you'll see your margin offers you that alternative, the grandmother of Asa the king, he removed her from being queen. The word in the Hebrew is Hagar Bira, and it means a principal lady, and it appears as though she occupied a very prominent position in the nation, because she had made an idol in a grove, and Asa cut down her idol and stamped it and burnt it to Brook Kidron. It's all very nice, isn't it, brothers and sisters? When you're dealing with ecclesial problems, problems that affect ecclesias far and wide, it's all very nice to stand 1,000 miles away and say, well, you ought to do that and you ought to get rid of this. But it's far more difficult when you've got to touch the problem in your own meeting and perhaps in your own family. And Asa showed enormous courage. He was Judah's first reformer, and it's always more difficult to be the first reformer than the second one, because there are no precedents. It's always more difficult. But more than that, he was a reformer who was prepared to take those reforms right into his own household. And he removed his grandmother, one of the most dominant forces in the nation, the favourite wife of Rehoboam, who held the reins of government even in the days of Abijah her son to a large extent. He got rid of her because the record says she had been prominent in the promulgation of idolatry, and she had made an idol in an Asherah. In fact, Rotherham translates that phrase, an idol, a monstrous thing. In fact, the margin even goes one better and says a horror. And the Hebrew word means just that, a terror or a cause of trembling, something which horrifies you. And brethren can share that experience with King Asa, because there are times, aren't there, brethren, when in the course of our employment or somewhere else, we encounter those horrors of this world that make a righteous man tremble. And like Lot in Sodom, when there is a public demonstration of evil that we can't avoid, we are vexed so that we tremble. She had made a cause of trembling in an Asherah, and he got rid of her. But we read in verse 17 of this 15th chapter, the high places were not taken away out of Israel. That is, he stopped the activity but didn't remove them altogether. It would be like closing down the churches but not knocking them over with a bulldozer, which is a good idea. But the high places were not taken away out of Israel. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was perfect all his days. I want you to note that phrase. King Asa never turned away from worshipping Yahweh as the true God. And yet he died a miserable specimen. And we've got to see why. He didn't turn away to idolatry, but he turned away to self-reliance. His heart was safe as far as Yahweh was concerned, but he came to worship himself in the end. And that is one of the most pernicious forms of idolatry that is possible. And so we see the courage of this man, Judah's first reformer. And he went about the task of purging that nation here in chapter 14, until we read in verse 4 of the 14th chapter, he commanded Judah to seek Yahweh God of their fathers and to do the law and the commandment. And he took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom was quiet before him. You see, brothers and sisters, what this record is trying to tell us is that the peace he enjoyed, the peace given to the ecclesia, was a blessing from Yahweh. It was a direct result of this man's righteousness, of his determined reformation. And Yahweh was saying to him, Asa, what you have done pleases me. The result will be peace. And we're going to see how he used that peace in a moment. I want you to notice, though, verse 4, where it says, and he commanded Judah to seek Yahweh. It is necessary at times, brethren and sisters and young people, for there to be clear, concise standards and directions in ecclesia life. It is necessary to know the bounds of acceptable behaviour. But we cannot leave it there. No ecclesia can function successfully or perpetually on the basis of legislation alone. We have to have something extra. And Asa understood that principle. So verse 6 we read, given peace for 10 years, quietness, he didn't sit down in an armchair and say, well, that's very good, Yahweh's given me peace, I'll have a rest. No, look at verse 6, and he built fenced cities in Judah. For the land had rest, and he had no war in those years, because Yahweh had given him rest. He knew it was a divine blessing. He used it properly and wisely. Therefore he said to Judah, verse 7, let us build these cities and make about them walls and towers and gates and bars. while the land is before us, because he expected the day of trial would come. He knew there would be one day, inevitably, an attack upon the brotherhood. He knew the time would come, brothers and sisters, and it did come. And he was not prepared to sit back in his armchair and say, well, things are going well here. We've been given peace because we've done the right thing by our God. He got out and worked. He built his ecclesia, and he built walls and bars and gates. And how do you do that in the ecclesia? Well, not literal walls, bars and gates. What you do is to take the minds of the brethren and sisters of the ecclesia and to build into them the positive and dynamic principles of truth, so they will stand by them. And they are the bars and the walls and the gates of the ecclesia, because they will not let the things into the ecclesia that we don't want. They themselves will hold them out. It doesn't depend upon one or two men or an arranging body. The whole ecclesia doesn't want it. And Asa understood that principle. And he built furiously in those 10 years of peace. And then look at the appeal at the middle of verse 7. This is what he's telling them. This is like an exhortation to the nation. Let us build these cities, he says, while the land is yet before us, because we have sought Yahweh our God. We have sought him. Have you ever wondered why he repeats that phrase? Can you get a picture of that man? With the people massed before him, perhaps on a special feast day. And they are there in expectation. And the king rises to give them an exhortation. And he leans over the lectern. And he says to his people, Judah, let us build. Let us work positively in the truth. Because we've been given a blessing. We've been given peace and quietness to do it. We have sought Yahweh our God, Judah, haven't we? We've sought him. Let's rise up and build on that basis. So you see, he's moved from legislation to appeal. And that, brethren and sisters, is the proper basis of building in the ecclesia of God. Yes, we must have our standards. It must be clearly known what we will accept and what we will not accept. But you can't build a strong ecclesia on that basis. You've got to build it on the basis of individual response, a desire for every member to become in their own right a bar or a wall or a gate to keep the enemies at bay. And so we read at the end of verse 7, they built and prospered. Marvellous, that, isn't it? What a wonderful thing he had done for the ecclesia of God. They built. Doesn't say he built. It says they built. But you'll notice at the beginning of verse 6 it said he built. The whole nation was now building because they'd got behind their king. And the word there for prospered means to push forward. And he pushed forward in the truth. And he had, verse 8, an army of men that bear targets or shields. And spears out of Judah, 300,000. And out of Benjamin that bear shields and drew bows. All of these, it says at the end of that verse, were mighty men of valour. What a description of an ecclesia that is. In Jeremiah's times there was no one, or virtually no one, who was valiant for the truth. And here we have a whole nation who were valiant men in the truth, prepared to stand up for the things that were right. And so in verse 9, the inevitable challenge comes. The 10 years of peace ends. And brothers and sisters, I think we'd be prepared to agree. But in this country of Australia, we have largely been given a time of peace over the last decade or so. What have we been doing with it? Have we been building positively? Well, you know, what we have built is going to be tested. It is being tested. And how is it going to be tested? Well, in exactly the same way that Yahweh was to test Asa and Judah. And look what happens in verse 9. There came out against them Zerah the Ethiopian with an host of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots. And he came unto Marashah. Now Marashah means the summit or the chief place. It was about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem, inside the boundaries of God's ecclesia. Zerah means, note this down if you haven't got a note up in your margin, his name means a rising of light. A rising of light. And he was an Ethiopian, and they never changed their skin. Once flesh, always flesh. The Ethiopian doesn't change his skin. And here, inside the boundaries of the Ecclesia of God, was a man who rose to the summit. He took a cheap place, as it were, and challenged Asa in Jerusalem to come out against him. And he was in the garments of light. And the challenge that you and I are facing today in the brotherhood of Christ is the challenge of humanism. It's the challenge of human rights. The rights of people to do what they want, to think what they want, and not to be told by anybody else what they can do or can't do. And if we don't think that that's in the brotherhood, well, we're blind. Because it is. And I know from looking at number one that it's a problem. Because we are all in some way affected by the civilization in which we live. And we can't help but take on board some of its ideas. We've got to reject them. But it does affect us. And the spirit of liberty, equality and fraternity, about which we spoke last year, is still doing its work in the world very effectively, but unfortunately it's still doing its work in the brotherhood. And we are being challenged from within, brethren and sisters, by something which has come from without. And it's in the garments of light, and even Satan himself has transformed into a messenger of light. Can we see it? Asa saw it for what it was. He saw it as a dynamic challenge to the truth. And so he goes out in verse 10 to set the battle in array in the valley of Zephathah. It means the watchtower. The enemy is in the chief place. Asa goes out to the watchtower. But he might look down upon the enemy and see what ought to be done. And yet, brethren and sisters, and this is the classic point of this chapter, though he had built up the ecclesia of God, when it came to the crunch, he knew that he could not win that battle in his own strength. He knew that all the preparations that had been made would be worthless if Yahweh was not in that battle. Now you look at the prayer of verse 11. I said he's a wonderful brother. You look at these words. Asa cried unto Yahweh his God and said, Yahweh, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. He had power. We've just been told that in verse 8. But he didn't see it that way. That's faith, isn't it, brothers and sisters? We've got to prepare for the challenges that will come. But when they come, we do not rely upon ourselves. We thrust ourselves like Asa upon Yahweh, and we cry, help us, O Yahweh our God, for we rest on thee. Now there's a very critical word in the life of King Asa, the first word on the page of the Oxford version of the Bible, in its left-hand page. The word rest. It is the Hebrew word she'an. It's spelled S-H-A-A-N. And it means, brethren and sisters and young people, to support oneself. To lean upon someone. So that Rotherham translates it, on thee do we lean, O Yahweh. And in thy name, he goes on, we go against this multitude. O Yahweh, thou art our God. Let not weak, mortal, sickly man, the Ethiopian, prevail against thee. The word there for man, as you probably are aware, is Enosh. And the margin assists you in that regard. Mortal, weak, sickly man. Don't let him prevail against you. So Yahweh smote the Ethiopians. Look at the words of verse 12. Before Asa and before Judah. Who was the one that had wrought that salvation for the nation? For whose sake had Yahweh come out against the Ethiopians? Yahweh smote the Ethiopians before Asa. It was his faith that had wrought that victory. And Yahweh rewarded it. And so verse 13 goes on to speak about the overthrow of the Ethiopians as they are chased out of the ecclesia. Asser and the people of William pursued them unto Gerar. Gerar, of course, was on the border between Judah, I should say, and Egypt. It was the border of the ecclesia, some 45 miles southwest of Jerusalem. They chased them unto Gerar, and the Ethiopians were overthrown. But they could not recover themselves, for they were destroyed before Yahweh. The word there for destroyed means to burst. An army of 1 million men was burst apart, and they chased them out of the ecclesia of God. And they carried away very much spoil. Just a point, by the way, there, brothers and sisters and young people, faced with this challenge of one who was garbed in the clothing of light, who had come within the borders of the ecclesia, Asser was quite content to drive him out of the ecclesia, but he did not pursue him beyond the boundary of the ecclesia. There's a point in that which needs to be thought about. We keep off their ground. We're only interested in preserving the ecclesia from the influences that have or might come into it. And so verse 14, they smote all the cities round about Gerar, for the fear of Yahweh came upon them, and they spoiled all the cities, for there was exceeding much spoil in them. They smote also the tents of cattle, and carried away sheep and camels in abundance, and returned to Jerusalem. Sounds just like an ordinary record of the wrapping up of a battle. But do you know that verse 15 is the pivotal verse of Asser's life? For here we have, in prophetic terms, as it were, what was to happen to this man. We know from the 11th verse of chapter 15 that they didn't just bring back sheep and camels, as is described for us in that last verse of chapter 14. They also brought back oxen, as well as sheep and camels. And yet it's only those two latter that are referred to in verse 15. Why is that so? Why does God, in the record, single out sheep and camels as being the spoil that came back under Asser? Well, you see, the next chapter, the next verse, says that as they returned, bearing the spoils of war, there came out to meet them a man especially sent by Yahweh to nip a problem in the bud. His name was Azariah, and he's spoken of in these terms, chapter 15 and verse 1. And the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. Do you know that in the record of Kings, you only find that phrase, the Spirit of God came upon someone, twice, here in this chapter, and in the life of King Joash, when it speaks of the Spirit of God coming upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. We shall have cause to look at that later on in the week, God willing. And so, brothers and sisters, we can see that this was a special message given by a special messenger who had been prepared by Yahweh for the task. And the Spirit of Yahweh came upon him, and he went forth to meet King Asser. This man's name, Azariah, means Yah has helped. He was the son of Oded, which means to reiterate. Yahweh had helped Asser, but he was about to reiterate a very important principle which was in danger of being forgotten. God had seen that there was a danger that faced King Asser. It faced many other kings as well, as we're going to see in the case of King Jehoshaphat and others. It's a danger that faces you and me, that when things are going well, we tend to sit back. King Asser had not done that. He'd been given 10 years. And in that 10 years he had built furiously. But Yahweh could foresee that the time would come when, having accomplished all that he thought he could accomplish, King Asser would take a comfortable seat and would cease to work. And so he tries to nip that problem in the bud. And you get the picture in your mind. Just imagine that you are Azariah, imbued with the Spirit of God. You go out to meet the victorious king, returning with all this great spoil. And the record says that the first two things that he saw were sheep and camels being led by King Asser. You know what, brothers and sisters? Sheep and camels are perfect symbols for that man. In the early part of his reign, he was the submissive sheep, prepared to be guided by the shepherd of Israel, prepared to submit to his principles, to his desire and to his will, prepared to labour on his behalf. But in the latter part of his life, he became the camel. You know what a camel represents, don't you? Under the law of Moses, a camel was unclean because though it chewed the cud, it had diseased feet, as it were. Didn't have the cloven hoof, and therefore it was unclean. It didn't walk in the way. We're going to see how apt that is for poor King Asa. For he died, as we well know, with diseased feet. He had ceased to walk in the way. Do you know, little sisters, that a camel can go for sometimes up to a week without water? Do you know that the camel can lose one third of its body weight in moisture and still survive, whereas one eighth in a human is fatal? There is no better symbol in the whole of the animal world for the self-reliant man than a camel. Have you ever had a look at them? You see them occasionally when a circus is in town. You go past and the camels. You have a look at them. They stand there chewing the cud. And they have, of course, upon their face, that complacent look. They reek of complacency, mind you, of other things as well. But they reek of complacency above all. And they stand there munching the cud. You cannot impress them. They are quite content to ignore you as they stand there munching away. And so the complacent camel becomes the symbol for the latter half, for the latter portion of King Asa's reign. And we'll show you how that unfolds. But before that, we have a glorious chapter in this 15th chapter of 2 Chronicles. A wonderful chapter. And so we read in the second verse that Azariah comes out to meet Asa and said to him, "Hear ye me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. Yahweh is with you while ye be with him." You know, there are some very simple principles in the Bible, brethren and sisters and young people. Very simple principles. And the older we grow in the truth, I'm not suggesting that I'm very ancient yet, but the older that we grow in the truth, the more we realise just how important they are. It is true, you know, that Yahweh is with us while we be with him. But it's also true that if we forsake him, he will forsake us. And this exhortation given to the king is one that we've got to take on board and make a part of our life every day. Yahweh is with you while ye be with him. Divine response is predicated upon our response to him. If ye seek him, you will find him. No question marks. I'll show you that Judah did that, and they proved that what was said was right. But if you forsake him, he cannot do anything else but forsake us. Simple, isn't it? It's like the principle of James chapter 4 and verse 8. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. It's like the principle of Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 3. I will be sanctified in them that draw nigh to me. It's a very fundamental principle. And you see, what God was saying to King Asa was, Asa, you've done marvellously well. I've given you a victory, but I can see that you're going to be tested by your prosperity. You're going to be tested by peace. You're going to be placed under a very severe trial, Asa, when nothing is happening around you to make you concerned or worried. It's going to be a severe trial for you, and you're going to slip back. So here he goes out in the form of this prophet, the warning. And then he goes on to say in verse 3, now for a long season Israel has been without the true God, which was true, and without a teaching priest and without law. They had a teaching priest now because, you see, Jehoiada the priest was at this stage 30 or 31 years of age. We will meet him, God willing, during the week on Thursday night, I think it is, in the life of King Joash.
we shall meet Jehoiada again. But he was a teaching priest who had begun to teach good things in Judah, and so they were prospering because of it. But when they in their trouble, verse 4, did turn to Yahweh, God of Israel, and sought him, he was found of them. And in those times, there was no peace to him that went out, or to him that came in, but great vexations were upon all the inhabitants of the countries. God does send trouble when there is unrighteousness, as well as sending it to bring a test upon us. And so verse 6, a nation was destroyed of nation, and city of city, and God did vex them with all adversity. Be ye strong, therefore. Well, the word for strong there, Chazak, means to be courageous or strong. And obviously, God could foresee that this man with strong hands would one day let those hands slip and find himself with diseased feet. Let your hands be strong, for your work shall be rewarded. Or as Rotherham translates it, there is a reward for your work. And so that was the exhortation. And when Asa heard those words in verse 8 and the prophecy of Azariah, the son of Ohad, as it should read, he took courage. Same word for strong in verse 7. He took courage and strengthened himself, and he put away what was left of the abominable idols out of all the land of Judah and Benjamin, and out of the cities which he had taken from Mount Ephraim, and renewed the altar of Yahweh that was before the porch of Yahweh. So he began another reformation. He renewed it, bringing new vitality to that nation. And he gathered all Judah in verse 9. Notice this verse. This, brethren and sisters, is proof positive of what we said earlier. But if you stand for what is right, there will be a reward. He gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and the strangers, or the word really should be rendered sojourners, as Rotherham has it. They weren't strangers in that sense, they weren't Gentiles. They were the sojourners with them who had come from Ephraim and Manasseh, the ones who had poured from the north, left behind their inheritance and come down to Judah. He gathered all of them together, and out of Simeon, for they fell to him out of Israel in abundance when they saw that Yahweh his God was with him. What is it saying, brothers and sisters? That where you have an ecclesia or ecclesias who stand for what is right and maintain that course, resisting all attempts to turn them from it, who hold to the standards of the truth, not because they wish to set themselves forth as Simon Pures, not because they are interested in the outward forms of religion, but because they believe it to be what Yahweh requires of them, when they stand for what is right, the blessings will come. And those who are outside that circle will look upon that and say, that's what I want for my children, that's what I want for myself, and I don't care about my inheritance here, I'm getting out. And they fell to him in abundance out of the north. When they saw that Yahweh his God was with him. And they saw the blessings of the truth in the ecclesia of Judah under King Asa. Now that, brethren and sisters, that is exactly what you and I must attempt to do. I don't read anywhere in the life of King Asa that he did anything other than that to help those who were outside the borders of his land. And that was a sound policy. His son came along and tried the opposite and ended up as a total disaster. And we shall talk about him on Tuesday evening. And so here we have in verse 10, they gathered themselves together at Jerusalem in the third month. That was the month when they held the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, which commenced on the fourth day. That was the feast at which they offered up the first fruits of the main harvest. And so there was an acknowledgement by Asa that Yahweh required the first fruits of his labours, the first and the best that he could give. And he gathered the people together to give it. Look what happened. It was in the 15th year of the reign of Asa that this occurred, and they offered in verse 11 unto Yahweh the same time of the spoil which they had brought, 700 oxen and 7,000 sheep. There's covenant in that, isn't there? Two sevens. And they entered into a covenant to seek Yahweh, God of their fathers, with all their heart and with all their soul. Where did that come from? We all know that it's from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5. That was the first and the greatest of commandments. Hear, O Israel, what does God want of you? He wants you to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And that's exactly what the entire nation was prepared to offer to him under King Asa. There were no hangers-on. There were no people who were hiding their true sympathies as there was in the days of Hezekiah. There were no Shebnas. There were no people digging their own graves in the days of King Asa. This reformation in Judah, brothers and sisters, was universal and complete. As complete as it's possible to be with human beings. Have a look at it. They entered, doesn't say he, it says they entered into a covenant to seek Yahweh. They believed the exhortation which said, if you seek him, you'll find him. And they did. So verse 13, they went further and said, having entered into that covenant to seek Yahweh with all our heart and with all our soul, we are prepared here today to say that whosoever would not seek Yahweh, God of Israel, should be put to death. So now we don't have Asa legislating in the ecclesia. Doesn't require Asa to stand up and say, brethren and sisters, this is what you shall do. It's the whole ecclesia stands up and says, we will not have that stuff in here. What a glorious ecclesia that was. And so they said, whether it be small or great, man or woman, they will not seek Yahweh with all their heart and with all their soul, they should be put to death. And they swear unto Yahweh, verse 14, with a loud voice. It wasn't something done with a private vote. With a loud voice, they swear to Yahweh. And with shouting and with trumpets and with cornets. They rejoiced in it, brothers and sisters. There was music. And all Judah rejoiced at the oath, verse 15, for they had sworn with all their heart. This is God's description of it, not anybody else's. This is what he thought of it. They rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart, and they had sought him with their whole desire. The word desire means delight or pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure to them that they could see the whole nation in which they were intimately involved themselves, each individual. They could see the whole nation determined to seek Yahweh with all their heart. Has that ever happened in your ecclesia? It might have happened. You know what that does for an ecclesia, brothers and sisters? It lifts it off the ground and propels it towards the kingdom of God in a way that you cannot do with legislation, can't do with rules and regulations. That was the condition of the ecclesia of Judah in the days of King Asa. Now what it then says at the end of verse 15, they sought him with all their heart, and he was found of them. There's your proof of verse 4, or verse 2. If ye seek him, ye shall find him. And again in verse 4, they had found him when they sought him. And Yahweh gave them rest round about. So he gave them more peace. But what did Asa do this time? Verse 18 says that he brought into the house of God the things that his father had dedicated, and that he himself had dedicated, silver and gold and vessels, which you might say in spiritual terms means that he brought into the house of God vessels that were there for the service of the ecclesia, in other words, human beings, and he dedicated them to the truth. Full stop. And for 20 years, that is all that the record says that Asa did. There were 20 years between the victory over Zerah, the Ethiopian, in chapter 15, and this wonderful reformation and rededication to Yahweh, and the events of chapter 16 and verse 1, because we're told at the end of chapter 15, and there was no more war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa. 20 years of peace, brothers and sisters. And all that's said of him is he dedicated a few vessels in the house of God. It seems as though King Asa did nothing of great significance in those 20 years. It seems as though he gradually sat back and reclined in the armchair, and he became a comfortable Christadelphian. And the camel begins to emerge in King Asa. The submissive sheep begins to disappear from the scene, and the camel comes forth, and the self-contented, complacent man emerges. And when trouble comes again, he can't handle it. Have a look at verse 1 of chapter 16. In the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah to the intent that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. So desperate had the position become in the north, with the immigration going on all the time, year after year, as people went down to Judah and stayed down there, that Baasha, the king of Israel, decided upon a policy of stopping it by force. So he went down to the border and he put up barricades, and he prevented people from going from Israel to Judah by force. Baasha, his name means, you know, to stink offensively. He smelt. Because, you see, he was a Bible school hater. He wasn't going to let his people go down to Jerusalem to the Bible schools. No way in the world. And he was prepared to use force to stop them. What did Asa do in response to this new problem? Well, 20 years earlier, we know what he would have done. But look at verse 2. Then Asa brought out the silver and the gold which he had put in the house of Yahweh. He brought out the treasures of the house of Yahweh and of the king's house and sent them to the son of the God of Thunder, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, that dwelt at Damascus, saying, there is a covenant. Same word that we encountered back in verse 12 of the previous chapter, Bereth, covenant. He said, there is a covenant between me and thee, as there was between my father and thy father. Behold, I have sent thee silver and gold, given away my redemption and my tried faith. Go break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may depart from me. What a terrible thing it was that this man had descended to making a covenant with a Syrian because he was attacked by his brethren in the north. He took on board Gentile methods and assistance in his warfare against his enemy in the north, and broke basically his covenant with Yahweh. How could he say that he was seeking Yahweh with all his heart now? Couldn't. So the covenant with Ben-Hadad had superseded the covenant of verse 12 of chapter 15. Shocking state of affairs, but you know what? It did happen. It happened. And look what happened as a result of it. So in verse 4, Ben-Hadad came down. He went out and he smote the cities of Ijon, Dan, Abel Maim, and the store cities of Naphtali. And when it came to pass that Baasha heard that this had been done, he left off building of Ramah and let his work cease. And then in verse 6, Asa, king of Judah, took all of Judah, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and the timber thereof wherewith Baasha was building, and he built Geba and Mizpah. Why couldn't he have taken all of Judah and done something about the threat of Baasha? Only he knew why. What we do know from Jeremiah 41 and verse 9 is that he was in such trepidation of this threat that he made a great trench, which later on became a place of burial for some poor folk slain by a wicked man in the days of Judah's demise. But a great trench was dug by Asa out of his fear for Baasha. He ought, brethren and sisters, to have thrust himself upon Yahweh, who had helped him before. And that's what he's reminded of by the prophet Hanani in verse 7. At that time, Hanani, and his name means gracious, for Yahweh was being gracious to Asa. He chastises his children when they require it, and he was about to chastise King Asa. But notice how he's described. At that time, Hanani, the seer. Remember the words of chapter 14 and verse 2, that Asa had done that which was good and right in the eyes of Yahweh? Here they were. The eyes of Yahweh. Hanani, the seer, means to see. He came to Asa, king of Judah, and said unto him, because thou hast relied on the king of Syria and not relied on Yahweh thy God, therefore is the host of the king of Syria escaped out of thine hand. Now if you took careful note of that word over on the left hand page at the top of the page in verse 11, rest, remember the word Sheon? Well, you might have to make a note of the fact, but in verse 7 it's used twice. And both occasions it is translated as relied. Asa's prayer to Yahweh when faced with the Ethiopian was, Yahweh, we rest upon thee, we lean upon thee. Same word used in verse 7. But the prophet comes to him and says, because you have leaned upon the king of Syria. The consequences of that are that he's escaped out of your hand. Now Asa must have shaken his head and said, well, what have I done? Brothers and sisters, it had been God's intention to destroy through Asa the king of Syria, and he'd gone and made a league with him to help him against Baasha, and so the world escaped out of his hand. He'd lost the chance to destroy the true enemy of the truth because he had made a league with them. He had leaned upon them. Well, you'd think, wouldn't you, that that would have been sufficient to convince this man. Verse 8, we read, the prophet goes on to tell him, reminding him of the great victory over Zerah. Were not the Ethiopians and the Lubans or the Libyans a huge host with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because thou didst rely, there's your word again, Sheon, because you leant upon Yahweh, he delivered them into thine hand. Look at the next words. For the eyes of Yahweh run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong, or to hold strongly with, as the margin has it. Those eyes of Yahweh, says Brother Ham, are ever running to and fro throughout the whole earth. They're always there, brothers and sisters, watching the affairs of his children, looking at the affairs of the ecclesia. God is concerned for his children. He was concerned for King Asa. Are not those eyes there, Asa, running to and fro to show themselves strong on behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him? Of course they were. Herein thou hast done foolishly. Therefore, from henceforth, you shall have wars. A direct consequence of your lack of faith, King Asa, will be trouble. And when you fill the flesh with what it wants, brethren and sisters, we know by experience that the result is trouble, isn't it? When the flesh becomes satisfied, then it will bring trouble into our lives. And King Asa had become a self-satisfied Christadelphian, quite happy to sit back in the armchair and to let things flow along. And when the crisis came, he couldn't handle it. And his heart began to shake. He had done foolishly. He was to be rewarded with wars. Now, if he had been a man of humility, without pride, he would have said, yes, you're right. I will repent of my ways and go back and see if we can recover ourselves. But look what he did in verse 10. Then Asa was wroth with the seer, and he put him in the prison house, for he was in a rage with him because of this thing. He was wroth with him. You know that word there for prison house doesn't actually mean a room where he locked him up. The word in the Hebrew, marpiketh, means a wrench, and has reference to the stocks So he took this prophet, Hanani, gracious, Yahweh being gracious to him, and he locked him up. He was the word of Yahweh in that land. He took the word of Yahweh and bound it by the feet. He got the stocks, which of course we know quite well from history books, were used to put men's arms or feet in, and they took out a wrench and they wound it down like a vice. And he locked up the feet of the prophet of God. He didn't stop there, brothers and sisters, because it also says, and Asa oppressed some of the people at the same time. And the word oppressed there, as you can see from the margin, means to crush. It is actually the word ratzats, and it means to crack in pieces. Quite a brutal word. He cracked in pieces the very people that he had brought to the pinnacle of spirituality in the truth. He had brought them to great heights. And now, because they criticized him, he crushed them. That's the flesh, isn't it, brothers and sisters? And pride is a killer. It kills the individual who's got it, and it kills others as well. And the pride of this man had come to the fore. The camel had emerged. The self-complacent Christadelphian. And you know what happened to him? Like the camel, he ended up with diseased feet. And the record says in verse 11, and behold the acts of Asa first and last. Lo, they are written. Sadly, they are written. Because we're reminded of a great man who came to a very tragic end. They are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Asa, in the 39th year of his reign, and 39 is 3 times 13, 3 is the complete number, 13 is the number of rebellion, complete rebellion against Yahweh, he would not turn, though he was rebuked. In the 39th year of his reign, his rebellion was complete, and he was diseased in his feet because he had locked up the feet of God's prophet. And it's a principle of life, isn't it? That we will always be repaid in kind with what we have done, especially to others. Jacob learnt that, and we have learnt it, have we not? And so, brothers and sisters, we find this tragic scene of this man who had done so much for God's creation, locked up himself because of diseased feet, the symbol of a corrupt walk. And it says that his disease was exceeding great, exceedingly severe, Brother Ham has it. Yet, and these are the tragic words, yet in his disease he sought not to Yahweh, the only healer of a diseased walk, but to the physicians. Remember, his name means physician, and we are being told that even in his extremity, Asa was not prepared to go to Yahweh, but he turned to himself. He turned to the Asas for help. If ever there was a phrase in the Bible which speaks about self-reliance, there it is. And that was his trouble. Reliance upon self. Complacency. Self-sufficiency. And those things are disastrous in the truth. Well, how did he end up? He ended up, brothers and sisters, being burnt. In verse 13 we read, Asa slept with his fathers, and he died in the 140th year of his reign. He never turned away from his rebellion against Yahweh. And they buried him in his own sepulchres, which he had made for himself. And the record says that because, you see, this man was content to die like that. He was like those Christadelphians on whose doors I've had to knock in recent times. To appeal to them to come back to the truth. People with enormous potential, a young brother, with enormous potential in the truth, who, because he got mixed up with friends in the world, left it. And it didn't seem to matter what you said to him. You couldn't get through to him. Yet he'd been one of the most responsive individuals I had ever had a pleasure to meet. You couldn't get through to him. You could say what you like. He was content to die in his sin, and is to this day. We know them, don't we? They have built sepulchres for themselves. They're happy to die like that. And they laid him in a bed which was filled with sweet odours, by his orders, doubtless. He had diseased feet. He was corrupt in his feet. The flesh was stinking and horrid. All he could do was to put sweet odours to make it smell better. You can't pretty up the flesh, brothers and sisters. You can't make a diseased walk any better by cosmetics. All you can do is turn back to Yahweh. And he wouldn't do it. He went to the ashes. And the spirit of self-reliance had brought this man to the grave. A miserable spectacle. And so we read that they made all kinds of spices prepared by the apothecary's art. And they made a very great burning for him. Now it has been suggested by some that this burning was to get rid of the corruption of his flesh. Disease in his feet, get rid of it by consuming it with fire. Not right. You see, in the record of 2 Chronicles 21 verse 19, we find another man called Jehoram. We won't turn to it if we haven't got time. Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, who also died in a terrible disease. His bowels fell out by reason of his sickness. If ever there was a case for a man to be burnt, it was in the case of King Jehoram. They didn't burn him. The record says that they made no burning for him. So the burning was not to get rid of the corruption. The burning was a mark of respect. And look at this spectacle. Here was a man who built this ecclesia up. It had strong walls and bars and gates. Individual brethren. They loved him for what he'd done for them, brethren and sisters. But then they'd seen tragically this man's demise, but through self-reliance and pride. And when he died, they made a great burning for him. They acknowledged what he'd done. Asa's reforms succeeded his own tragic failure. The things he had done for the brotherhood of Christ lived on beyond his own tragic end. And they marked their respect for him with a great burning. They loved him, brethren and sisters, as you and I love him. But tragically, he probably will not be in the kingdom of God. What a warning that is. What a lesson there is for us, brethren and sisters, upon whom devolve the responsibility for guiding God's ecclesia today. We have an enormous responsibility. We must be cautious. We must beware of peace and prosperity. And when we're given that, as we have been in this land largely, we ought to get about the business of building up the ecclesia. Let our hands be strong. Let's be courageous, brothers and sisters. Let's work diligently amongst those who will receive the word of God and who will become walls and bars and gates, because trials will come. They will come from without and within, and faith is the key to our victory. We must let our hands be strong and our eyes watchful, because we know that Yahweh's eyes watch all, and his eyes are running to and fro through the whole earth on behalf of those whose heart is perfect towards him. Let us then conclude our consideration of this man Asa by just going back to the words of the prophet Azariah. Verse 7 of chapter 15. And here's the exhortation for every single one of us. There's a divine guarantee that if we seek Yahweh, we shall find him, brethren and sisters. There's no question about that. But we will need to be strong. And we will have to make sure that our hands are not weak. And we'll need to keep reminding ourselves that though we are not worthy of it, there is a reward for your work.